What happens if you separate power from feelings is that you separate compassion from action and empathy from action.
Hi, Vicki Robin here, host of What Could Possibly Go Right, a project of the Post-Carbon Institute. We interview cultural scouts, people who see far and serve the common good, and social artists, people who feel deeply and inspire us. Today's guest is Susan Griffin, and our conversation plumbed the inner dimensions of our multiple crises we are facing, in fact, that we are in the middle of. She has novel takes on this transition we are in, that we are becoming a web rather than hierarchies. Susan has written over 20 books, including nonfiction, poetry, and plays. Her work addresses many social and political issues, social justice, the oppression of women, ecology, war and peace, economic inequalities, and democracy. Often she approaches her subject at a slant, using and following the music of language, metaphor, stories, and incidents from her own life to reveal the underside of larger histories and realms. Her book, A Chorus of Stones, The Private Life of War, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and a New York Times Notable Book of the Year when it was published. Women and Nature, considered a classic of environmental writing, is credited for inspiring the ecofeminist movement. The Book of Courtesans introduced a hidden chapter in women's history. Her new book is Out of Silent Sound, Out of Nothing Something, A Writer's Guide. And now here's this wonderful conversation with Susan Griffin. Hello, Vicki Robin here, host of What Could Possibly Go Right. My guest today is Susan Griffin, and welcome, Susan, and thank you for agreeing to share your wisdom with all of us. I am such a fan. In your body of work, you consistently weave personal stories of longing and loss with immense issues of war, assault on nature, racism, extraction, sexism, democracy, and more. So you do a weave, you plumb your own life courageously, as well as histories and biographies and psychology and scholarship, to show us the basic split that drives us to ruin, the split between nature and human will, masculine and feminine, self and other, and body and soul. I love, you know, it's like you paint with ideas and words and stories. You paint a picture, you don't just march along. And most often people address this crisis by dissecting it, by trying to fix the problem rather than heal the soul. And you do just the opposite. So you are a unique guest for us who can shine a light on the soul of the earth and our human presence. What sense are you making of this time of coming apart? What connections between issues or disparate ideas are you seeing? What metaphors or stories are you drawing on now to understand and respond to these upheavals? And finally, and most importantly, how and where do you see light shining through? Are we in a healing crisis? What is trying to be born now? So I hope you will muse with us on this invitation. And I will ask you now our one question. Amidst all that seems to be going awry, what could possibly go right?
Wonderful. Well, you're probably going to be surprised at my answers, but one of the things that's going right or has gone right recently, which has really rattled the far right, is that drag queens are very popular now among determinedly heterosexual people. Now, why am I excited by that? Well, of course, they're a lot of fun, and we all love to laugh. But there's a deeper message there in what the drag queens are doing. I myself didn't even get it in the late 70s, early 80s. I told one interviewer, I was a writer then too, I told one interviewer that I thought that I was critical of drag queens because I thought they were satirizing women. But that's not what they're doing. And I came soon after to really understand it, and I understand it better and better as I go on. What I'm going to quote here, RuPaul here, he's brilliant. I recommend everybody go to his website or find some place where he holds forth. He's really quite brilliant. And one of the things he said that's memorable is, we're all in drag. Meaning, we're all trying to fit into these categories of gender, which are really not very real. They're based on ideology and power networks of power. They don't reflect natural gender. Who knows what natural gender really is, but it certainly is not what society demands of us. And therefore, what's wonderful about the drag queens is that they're challenging that whole system of gender, and in a way that's delightful. And they're poking fun, and it's wonderfully freeing. By the way, women often dress in drag. I mean, and I'm not only talking about lesbians, I'm talking about women in general. Every once in a while, a sort of tuxedo style becomes very popular, very, very fashionable. So we like it. It's a wonderful release to cross over those boundaries. And so my work has addressed those boundaries, the boundaries of gender, or the binding of gender might be a better way to put it, for years. I did it in one book called Woman in Nature, in which I associate the idea of gender with nature and the exploitation of nature. And really, any group that's devalued, that has been devalued historically in the West, women, people of color, people of different nationalities, are considered to be closer to nature. That's usually one of the first justifications for them being treated as inferior, is that they're closer to nature. I'll never forget, in the, I think it was in the 60s or 70s, when there was a California senator, I can't remember his name now, but George Murphy, maybe, he was an actor also. And he said, Mexicans are better at doing farm work because they're closer to the ground. Can you imagine? I mean, I hate to laugh at racism, but it is, when you get down to brass tacks, it's pretty stupid, you know. But it's anything that's closer to the ground, by the way, is inferior. The ground is inferior, even though it's the ground we walk on, and the ground that has given birth to us, and the ground that establishes everything we know and every capacity we have to know. It's considered inferior and beneath us, because there's this illusion which is furthered or codified and enforced through gender, that some people are more of the spirit. I'm not talking about spirituality, which is a wonderful thing, but I'm talking about the idea of spirit and matter being separate, and spirit being superior. So it becomes actually the opposite of true spirituality, because it's a method of controlling and exerting power over other people who are defined as a class as inferior. So we have this complex, and America is becoming even more oriented, although not in the general population. And that's something that I feel is we have to pay attention to. The majority of people don't think this way anymore. But those in power do. They think that that there is a kind of scale of superiority, inferiority, and superiority that can be measured, and not only measured, but that society can be stratified based on that, and should be. And so people who are doing service jobs, waiting on tables, or secretaries, or working in factories, are considered inferior, and they're to be paid less. We know that's not the case. Any of us who have done that work, any of us who have family that have done that work, they're paid less, but they're no less. Oftentimes the workers are much more knowledgeable about what should be done on an industrial site than the people who own and manage it, because they're away from the material reality of it. And so part of the system is to create a class that is separated from material reality. They don't cook their own meals. They don't clean the toilets. You know, they can have the illusion that they don't eat and defecate. They sort of live in a cloud that it, you know, and it's interesting that we talk about the cloud in cyberspace, but they live in a cloud that doesn't touch anything material, and matter is considered inferior. So that's the major theme of Woman in Nature, that woman is associated with matter. Matter is inferior, and spirit is superior. Now, the great the great insight that Einstein had and that several other physicists came to it about the same time in the 20th century was that matter and spirit are not separate. Of course, the scientific terms for that would be matter and energy. The word for energy and light and spirit in Greek is all the same word.
Mm.
And the concept of spirit became the concept of energy. It evolved into the concept of energy in science. And when the atom was investigated, they realized at the heart of the atom is energy. So we're not, you know, but what do we do? What as a culture did we do about that? We split the atom and created terrible destruction and death in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And are tyrants are still, like such as Putin, are still threatening the world with the power of this weapon. And the United States did so over many, many years, many decades and centuries even, or one century. So this, what we're doing when we split matter from energy is we're splitting ourselves. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways we've split ourselves is to create these concepts of gender that are completely false. Masculine having the power to do things and feminine having emotions and feelings. And what happens if you separate power from feelings is that you separate compassion from action and empathy from action.
Mm.
And the basic material principle of connectedness, material and spiritual principle of connectedness, if I do anything to anything on this earth, it's going to come back to me because it affects the whole. And that understanding of how we're woven into and part of a whole. And when we don't have that understanding, death is really fearsome. If we have that understanding, death is always frightening. Come on, let's get real.
Right.
I don't, but I am going to. I'm 80. It'll happen. It happens to us all. But we can't come to terms with death in this culture, and therefore we create more death. And the reason we can't come to terms with it is that we are so alienated from natural process. So I want to talk to you a little bit about a new book I've written, Out of Silence, Sound, Out of Nothing, Something. And it's a writer's guide. It's a book on how to write. I've taught writing for over 50 years, and I love teaching it because I get to witness this sort of miracle of something being created from something new. And we all have new things that are new to the culture in us in some way or another. Let me read you from the second chapter. The chapters are all very short, because I wanted a lot of space in this book. There's a lot of blank space. You can see in this one, there's all this blank space here.
Mm. Thank you. I can see that.
You want that blank space because that's what you need when to write. If you want to really mine the your own depths, which are the same as the depths of the universe.
Mm.
There is an inexpressible magic by which something, the title of this chapter is Mystery. There is an inexpressible magic by which something comes from nothing, a miracle of creation that happens all over the world, not just once, but again and again. As frequently as this conjuring act occurs, it never seems commonplace. This is not a predictable process. To produce anything of value, you must travel over a narrow bridge between resolve and acceptance.
Hmm.
Whether it's a few words, an image, a turn in the plot, the manner in which the narrator speaks, you cannot control exactly what will come to you. After all, if you knew exactly what was coming, it would not be new. But you can prepare the ground. And I talk about how to do that.
Yeah.
So that's why I find drag, the new appreciation of drag, very promising, a very good sign. Even though there are those attacking it, even the fact that some are attacking it shows how significant it is. That the fear of drag, which is also goes along with people who are against abortion, who are for private citizens being able to purchase weapons of war and without being checked in their background, without, you know, allowing weapons of war at all to be on our streets, you know, it's this group, and they have a coherent philosophy. And that coherent philosophy, which seems to us to be utterly incoherent, but you can understand it as a defense against nature, against the material world, which is also the spiritual world, but they don't understand that. They're split. They are themselves severely divided. So it's really a kind of mental illness. And we see it as such, I think, more clearly now with the sort of madness surrounding Trump, how crazy it is. But it's the craziness of the West, and we've all suffered from it, and we all are still in some way or another suffering from it.
Yeah, I agree that we're getting to understand better and better the insanity of the worldview that's woven into our flesh, you know, that's we've been soaked in. And so it takes constant effort to like open up your mind and see, like, wait a second, that thought that I'm having is not real. It comes out of culture, society, it comes out of programming. I'm interested in so much of what you said. And thank you for sharing your new book. I plan as a writer to read it. You bring up drag, and I think that's wonderful. And I've loved RuPaul for a long time, ever since I first saw him. He's amazing. I think there's a lot of gender issues that are being raised right now, and that young people are doing it. They are insisting that I have a friend who says, I'm queer. It's just like, I'm what I am. I'm not a gender. And sometimes I like to wear frilly things, and sometimes I like to wear serious things. And we were talking about, you know, LGBTQIA+. We were talking about the contribution to society it is that young people are unpacking gender, you know, and there's resistance. I mean, the resistance is growing because in the right, because it's getting more and more visible. So I loved that observation. If you have anything else to say about, you know, how gender issues in general are emerging in our society.
Yeah, they're emerging all kinds of ways. I mean, the resurgence of feminism, and that a lot of men have joined the feminist movement, which is a really very good sign, because the gender system harms men as much as it does women, but because they're offered positions of power, but most men don't sit in positions of power; they're oppressed by men in power. But they still that with that offers, they're sort of like the offer that poor white people were given after Reconstruction in the South. There was a very powerful coalition between poor white farmers and sharecroppers and Black people, African-American people who had been freed from bondage. And very consciously, the slave owners, the former slave owners, kept selling to the poor white farmers, you're part of the superior class. Your whiteness makes you superior. And they fell for it. But now I think that old bond is starting to reassert itself. It's being made again in the South.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And you also said that, you know, you indicated that in terms of drag, but also other things that most people are not with that extreme right-wing program, you know. And so is that your sense that, you know, because you sit in Berkeley, which is, you know, such a hub of conscious, you know, politics and consciousness. But, you know, what are you seeing about how these ideas are seeping in beyond the power holders being able to stop it?
Well, I just remember, you know, just not that many years ago. I mean, I'm 80 years old now, so, you know, but maybe 10 years ago, I couldn't bear to listen to the news because there was hardly anybody who would tell the truth. And now MSNBC is on, you know, 24 hours a day most days. And they're telling a lot of truth, you know. So, and we have the internet, and, you know, the internet is problematic, but it also is bringing news that didn't reach people before to many people. So one of our problems that now is that there's no kind of Walter Cronkite. There's nobody that everybody trusts. But I think we can't have that until we are able to trust ourselves, our own perceptions. We're past having, you know, a white-haired grandfather tell us what's true. We've come past that. And this is very rocky terrain that we're in now. It's in between. It's in between having a wise old authority tell us what's true and learning to discern the truth ourselves, you know, do our own fact-checking, believe our own eyes and ears. There's a passage in, The Origins of Totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt. I've quoted from many times because it seemed to me to be so important. And she talks about, still seems to me that is very important. She talks about how Goebbels, who was the minister of propaganda, basically, in the Third Reich, would give these radio broadcasts. And when the Allies were bombing Germany, he would say they're not able to, because of our air defense, they're not able to really do very much harm to our cities. And there would be people who were sitting with rubble all around them saying, well, and instead of saying Goebbels is lying or Goebbels doesn't know the truth, they said, he must know something we don't. An authoritarian psychology, you know, and I think that's what we are trying to get past. It's a hard birth. It's very hard to get past that because it's particularly in this world with so many unnatural dangers. Atomic nuclear weapons do not constitute a natural danger. Radioactivity, when it's in the ground, is not a danger to us. Hasn't been on a wide scale. But we produced weapons that made it very dangerous. So global warming is something that we have created. It has not happened naturally. So we've created these outsized dangers that feel overwhelming. So it's a very hard birth to get past authoritarianism when there's so many fearsome realities out there. But it's the only way that we're going to be able to get to be able to answer climate change with getting rid of fossil fuels. And I think one thing we really need to do is to begin to understand the psychology behind what we're doing now, that our desire to have someone who knows all, who tells us what to do, is understandable. It's human, but it's at this point not very productive. It's gonna get us all killed, basically.
So talk about that transition some. Talk about this birth. My friend Hazel Henderson passed away about a year ago. And
did you hear that?
Yeah, and she, in her final conversation with me, she said, I'm going to use a bad word. She said, next 5 years are going to be a shit show. So, yeah, so strap in and have fun, you know, basically. And so is this a birth? Is this, so are we in a birth canal? Are we being?
We are. And of course we know that things can go wrong in the birth canal. You know, the fetus can be suffocated. The mother can bleed to death, you know, so we are in a very delicate period and we have to be as conscious as we can and as aware of our inner life as we can. The more we learn about our own inner lives, our own fears, and with a kind of tolerance and empathy, the more we can understand what's going on in others, even those we disagree with, and can help the situation. I have to say, you know, I get very angry at right-wing people like, you know, certain certain representatives, especially right now, Jim Jordan drives me crazy. And I'd love to just swear at him, but that's not productive.
Right.
He's used to that. He knows how to handle that. He's had probably had that all his life. Somebody probably yelled at him when he was a kid, you know. So how do we untangle ourselves from this terrible mental illness with which we've all been afflicted? That's the question. It's only one side of it. I'm not saying this is all that we do. It's not. But it's a side that can't be ignored.
Do you see that, you know, you've taught writing for 50 years. Do you see that shift happening in the, I assume the young people that you teach, that now young people are actually further along in that process of understanding the inner dimension of the outer problems?
Oh, yes, I definitely see that. Yes. And I see it in the literature that's being produced. I'm just reading a book now called After Sappho. It's very, very daring in its form and marvelous. I read a book called Memorial Drive. She's a wonderful writer, really wonderful. And she's also a poet, Natasha Trethewey. Just an astonishing account of the death of her mother.
Mm.
So there's really a lot of awareness that's coming out available to us now.
So talk to us a little bit about, you know, there's a fear that if we go within, you know, if we just create this as a personal healing crisis, that we have to work on ourselves. I mean, this is a split in my generation. You know, there was those who got political and those who went on the spirituality route. So what are you doing? What are you doing on the outer level, or what do you see happening on the outer level that is an integrated, something that has integrated the inner awareness and is an expression of, what do you call it, activism, or addressing frontally the destructive forces, the, you know, fascistic forces?
No, there's a lot happening. I love all the work done at 350.org, and now, what is it called, Third Act, the new.
Right.
They're very creative, and they don't sort of have to prove themselves as revolutionaries. I knew there was a feeling. I grew up in this. I came of age in the 60s. I was part of the movement that preceded the free speech movement at Cal, at UC Berkeley. And we were often very combative in our manner, even though we used peaceful methods of protest. And this, you know, 350.org has a different feel to it.
Many do now.
Inviting awareness. And one of the things that has been demonized by the right, but which is so unfair and distorting to demonize it, is Black Lives Matter. That is such a moot. Can you think of another name of a movement that is so moving? And you know, Black Lives Matter, that a people, I mean, when I think about that a people have to say my life matters, proves everything. That you have to say in a slogan, my life matters, Black Lives Matter. They don't have to argue that racism exists. The very fact that they feel compelled to say this and that they need to say this is a proof of how lethal racism is in our country. That's a beautiful, beautiful slogan. So there's, you know, the young people are very creative right now in how they're protesting under conditions which are terrible. They're worse than we were facing. We were coming out of McCarthyism. McCarthyism was pretty bad, but this is really worse.
Well, because it's existential. It's
existential. That's right.
Yeah. And I mean, I know that every generation, or maybe every other generation, has a threat that they consider existential, but this one is, because we could shut down the natural cycles, or we could affect them in such a way that it's irremediable for hundreds of thousands of years. It's
and that's already happened on some levels. I mean, it's not like we're going to be able to turn things back. Maybe in a couple hundred years we will, but right now I live in a zone that's famous for being temperate, and it certainly hasn't been temperate this year. It got very cold. We had this rain that produced a lot of flooding, and these very strong winds that knocked trees down and power out. And, you know, and we were suffering from the least of it. It wasn't, you know, we didn't have hurricanes and tornadoes.
Right. In a way, what I'm hearing from you is that if we want to know where to apply ourselves to remedy, whatever remedy there might be, you just look at the right wing talking points and you understand that that's an expression of the fear. It's sort of like, you know, they're the indicator species of the kind of emergence that's happening now.
Yes.
Yeah. Was there more that you wanted to say about any topic? And if you say something that I'm interested in, I'll send us back into it. Right.
I think we have to start taking our culture more seriously. And I'm not talking about or advocating in any way censorship here, but just appealing to those who are the creators of culture. They make a lot of money off superheroes, and some of them are fun and slightly satiric and making parodies, and some of them are quite serious. But what would, in addition to allowing AK-15 combat weapons onto the into our cities and streets, we're also releasing this image of masculinity and then now also femininity. There's Superman and Superwoman as invulnerable, as violent. And, you know, as long as your violence is in what's called the good, you know, it's all right. You can just murder people with impunity. And so we're wondering about folks who, in a mental crisis, pick up a gun and go and shoot people. When we create these mythologies that are very powerful, and cinematic form is extremely powerful on the psyche, and bombard the majority of our cult young people with these images, and with without other images that show how we're all connected, how nobody has that degree of power, because that's just how it works. Our power comes from coalitions and webs and connections. I think we need to start to be more conscious about the culture we create. Even those who want to make a lot of money, you can find a way to make money off of connection, believe me.
Yeah. Make a career out of connection. It's almost like what I hear you saying is that systems thinking or connectivity or understanding the interrelationship between things is the essential, you know, step out of the old story. Being able to see how things weave together. And I think I see that in your writing, that you weave personal stories and history, and you weave all these things together so that we can see that all is connected.
Yes.
And so resisting disconnection is disconnected. Yeah. How do we, you know, I guess we just are all going to be inventive about how we embody connection. And to do it in a way that's connected, that isn't othering. You know, I have a great passion for, you know, healing the divide in the community I live in. But I don't think it's totally from a connected consciousness. I'm trying to see how we can connect on a soul level or somehow with people who are frightened and are placing themselves as opposition to us. How do we get through? What, you know, I mean, if we write this literature about connectivity, you know, these beautiful stories, and they never show up in the, you know, in the venues where people who are hostile to diversity show up. I mean, like, where does how does this bleed out? You know, how does it how does it, how do you do the weave in real time in this life right now?
I think it's a question that requires creativity. I mean, you have to be patient and let it, and there's not a single answer. There's no single answer.
Right. So, okay, Susan, is there more that, you know, culture, gender, climate?
Well, the only thing I would add is that I find it extremely compelling and interesting that people need meaning. They need meaning as much as food, water, and air. And we don't, we address that with, instead of be the dietary equivalent of feeding sugar rather than looking for real nutrients. And we don't teach people to search for the meaning in themselves. And so that's one path I would suggest.
Mm-hmm. And meaning often comes through stories, you know,
that you
read and that you tell.
Exactly.
So that's back around to, if you want to mention your book again, that's back around to you trying to give us this gift of how to be storytellers.
Yeah, it's called Out of Silence, Sound, Out of Nothing, Something, A Writer's Guide.
It's beautiful. I know I shock myself when I show up to the page and, you know, what tumbles out. So, yeah, may we all learn to tell our stories with compassion and you know, humility and dive for the truth, you know, which is what you do in your literature.
Yes, and let your stories tell you also.
Right. Right. And as you said, it's going to be messy. It's going to take a while. Not everything is going to work, even though you hope it will. So that's the nature of the time that we're in, is it's, if you're in the birth canal, there's nothing predictable. You know, you've left the predictable space.
Yes. So, it's dark. You can't see ahead.
Exactly. So we have to learn to tolerate the dark.
Yes, we do. And there's also, though, this experience where I experienced it more than once. First with the McCarthy movement, and I know that people in my generation, everybody I knew was against McCarthyism, and suddenly McCarthyism started to disappear. You know, but we didn't really know that was going to happen. It did, mm-hmm. and the same thing happened with the women's movement. You know, everybody was saying, oh, well, that was back in the 19th century with Susan Anthony, and women got the vote in 1920, and now women are fine. And then suddenly this awareness started, and there was this huge wave that happened. It was called the second wave. And I think that's happening now with ecology, with the climate change movement and the movement for democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And the wave hasn't crested yet. It's still the
no, country. But we can be part of it.
Yes.
Yeah, we can be part of it. Thank you so much, Susan, for taking this time with us and helping us to see the inner dimensions of the, you know, the polycrisis, the inner dimension, what's really happening here. So I really appreciate it.
It was lovely to talk with you.
Hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review so that this hopeful message can get out to more people. Check out Postcarbon Institute's Resilience website for show notes and for more guest information. Thanks also to Asher Miller, Amy Buringrud, and Clara Winter of Postcarbon Institute, plus production assistant Michelle Wigg from frugalityandfreedom.com.